It's Wednesday, March 1st, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Trump administration's attempts to crack down on leaks coming out of the White House. Rank the states and where would Missouri land? We'll talk about a U.S. News and World Report feature that has created a definitive list of all 50 states. What was the criteria used for that and who beat us? Please, please, please don't say Kansas. And this year's Oscars may be the most memorable ceremony to date. We'll talk about what went right, what went wrong, and everything in between. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but we'll start with Friday's limited press gaggle, a more limited off-camera briefing held in Sean Spicer's office instead of the press room. And reporters from the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Politico, BuzzFeed, and CNN were intentionally excluded.
Are CNN and the New York Times not in here right now because you're unhappy with their reporting?
No,
and why are they not in here?
Because we had a pool and then we expanded it. We added some folks to come cover it.
But there's enough room for others.
It was my decision to decide, you know, to expand the pool.
And we're going
to
aggressively push back.
We're just not going to sit back and let, you know, false narratives, false stories, inaccurate facts get out there.
Well, Spicer says not every briefing needs to be televised and not every briefing needs to include every member of the White House press corps, especially when there are pool reporters in attendance. Several news agencies chose to stay out in solidarity, including the Associated Press and Time magazine. And since this happened Friday, The New Yorker is among those who've said that it won't return. Once again, CNN found itself getting some support from a competitor turned increasing ally, Fox News's Shep Smith.
For the record, fake news refers to stories that are created, often by entities pretending to be news organizations, solely to draw clicks and views and are based on nothing of substance. In short, fake news is made-up nonsense delivered for financial gain. CNN's reporting was not fake news. Its journalists follow the same standards to which other news organizations, including Fox News, adhere. Senior administration officials regularly speak without attribution so that the public can be informed of what our government is doing. Off the record, just as CNN reports previous Senate officials to speak off the record against the Russia Trump campaign reporting.
If Shep Smith can stumble, so can I. This administration has said that no one agency's access is ever going to be guaranteed. We saw that this week.
Well, and I have to say, thank you, Shepard Smith. Thank you to Chris Wallace and a few other journalists at Fox who are sticking up for their colleagues. Now go tell that to Bill O'Reilly and Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and the folks who were on and commentating on primetime. But it is true that Sean Spicer, I mean, he's right. You don't have to have everybody in every briefing. These things called gaggles are set up so that, you know, you don't have to have the TV cameras present. They do have pool reporters who can be there to share content with those who can't be a part of it. But it's pretty obvious, given the whole context and what was said during the briefing, that he shut out the New York Times and CNN and Politico and BuzzFeed and the Los Angeles Times because he didn't like their reporting.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a continuation of what we've seen throughout not only the first month of Trump's presidency, but you can go all the way back to the campaign. When you aren't producing, I want to say you, I mean the media, when the media is not producing the kinds of news that promote what Trump wants to promote, he attacks. And this is all a part of the strategy that he's followed throughout all of this.
One of the strategies that was to be prescribed from the very beginning of the Trump administration and had been transparent that this was going to be one of the plans was to grant greater access to local and regional reporters, part of that being the Skype seats that were going to be made available in the press room. Monday, he invited 18 local and regional reporters to a meal at the White House, giving them an opportunity, some parts on the record, some parts off. Is this part of that shift in strategy we're seeing there?
Sure, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think we've talked about this a bit on the show before. If he wants to expand the pool of journalists who get access to him, if he wants to give conservative media organizations an opportunity to ask questions as often as other news organizations, fine. But that's different from something that's really precedent-setting. I mean, the Obama administration tried briefly, I think back in 2008 or 2007, to exclude Fox News from a briefing with one of the administration officials. articles.
2009, yeah.
And the other media stuck up for Fox News, and the White House backed down. This is the first time, as far as anybody knows, that a White House press secretary has deliberately kept somebody out of a gaggle, and I think it sets a bad precedent.
Well, I mean, it's first time in modern era. I mean, you know, being a historian and looking at reporting, the White House Press Association for a long time kept out small newspapers. They kept out weekly newspapers. They kept out magazines. And in particular, they kept out the ethnic press, including the African-American press, for a long time. So what we're seeing here in this instance is where you have a White House that is specifically going after media organizations that they feel aren't covering them in the way that they want to be covered. And that's different than keeping the news media out because of racial discrimination or because they feel like they don't reach a larger audience.
It looked for a while yesterday like perhaps the White House was changing its stripes a little bit because the president had in some of the television news anchors for a private briefing before he gave his address to Congress last night. And supposedly in this meeting, I mean, there were lots of TV journalists there, so one suspects that they weren't all making this up. The president said something about how he might be willing to compromise on immigration and come up with a plan that might give the Dreamers and others who are here illegally but haven't otherwise broken any laws or done anything violent, that they might have a way eventually to get a path to be legally in the country. None of that came out in his speech. Journalists talked about it for hours leading up to the speech, and he didn't say anything of the kind during the speech itself.
But that's a part of the pattern as well, because even if you go back and you look at the campaign, they would forcefully go after the media in a certain way, and then they dial it back. And then you'd have this sort of couple of days of, okay, everything is sort of calm, and then all of a sudden it's right back into the attack mode. So I would not be surprised if we didn't see something either at the end of this week or the first of next week that would demonstrate that pattern again. I mean, that's just the way in which Trump and the people who work for him operate.
I will say, though, having watched the speech last night, that it really was significantly different in some ways from the way that the president has spoken and dealt with the media in the past couple of weeks. I mean, first of all, he did pretty much stick to the teleprompter the entire time. He made noises about collaboration and cooperation on important things and putting aside petty differences. Didn't give a lot of specifics about that. And then he really stage managed one aspect of that speech last night very well. I mean, it was Ronald Reagan-esque. He had the widow of of the Navy SEAL who died in the raid in Yemen. I mean, it was hard to watch in some ways. You felt so badly for her. You felt really proud of her. The camera was on her, though, for it seemed like it was two minutes.
A long time, yeah.
Really anguishing. She's praying. She's talking to her dead husband. She's the tears. I mean, this was quite a moment because Trump managed with that one effort to get her to sit by Ivanka to probably put down the entire week's narrative about how the father of the dead Navy SEAL was attacking the president, refused to meet him when his son's body came back into the country. I mean, think about that moment for Trump compared to what he did in the campaign when he attacked the family of the dead Muslim American soldier.
Right. I mean, what you saw last night was Trump staying on message. It was very well crafted. The speech itself was sort of out of line with what we've seen from Trump recently. But now, all of a sudden, you start seeing a more presidential Trump. The question becomes, is that what we're going to see from here on out, or is it going to be the sort of back and forth that we've seen from him in the past? And that is what, at least from the media commentary that I've seen, they're wondering, okay, is this a new Trump, or is this just Trump sort of trying to placate certain parts of the American population that are saying, wait a minute, you know, this is just too confrontational. It's too argumentative. We need someone who is going to to basically show some sort of statesmanship, which we have not seen from Trump.
He veered off a little, well, I don't know if it was off message, but he veered off that sort of statesmanlike approach toward the end. And the only time he was booed, I mean, the Democrats in Congress sat on their hands most of the speech, but he was booed actually one time when he announced a new initiative called Voice Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, a group for families who've been harmed by illegal immigrants who've committed some crime against them, and was actually booed because he kind of made it sound like, you know, all immigrants are committing crimes.
Right. Well, one of the reasons cited for Friday's happenings, why that gaggle was limited, continued concern in the White House communications office about leaks. According to a story broken by Politico over the weekend, staffers were called into a room and their cell phones checked for encrypted messaging apps. Why? Well, The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza shared this story on CNN.
Spicer was upset because the new communications director, the name of that new communications director was leaked a week ahead of time. Now, he is a mm-hmm. friend and ally of Spicer, so perhaps he saw this leak as somehow undercutting him, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, that's when White Houses start to get really dysfunctional, when the factions start to go to war with each other in the mm-hmm. press, and then they try and clamp down on the leaks, and that doesn't work.
So what do you think of his theory laid out there?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, you saw it in Bush in George W. Bush's mm-hmm. administration. You saw the same thing with Obama. When you have factions within an administration that start to go after leaks, go after people they perceive to have leaks, then all of a sudden you begin to have these sort of tit for tats going on within, and these various cliques start to sort of point out one against the other, and that causes dysfunction. Now, you know, in Obama, he pretty much said no drama. That was one of the few times where you saw drama in the Obama administration, was when they tried this aggressive going after leaks thing. And I mean, it just stopped immediately because it brought up more drama than it did clamping down on leaks. And the same thing is going to happen here. The question becomes, when are they going to figure out, okay, we can't really manage this whole stopping the leaks
because
thing.
The leak came right out of that.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, no more leaks, and then we find out through a massive leak what happened.
You have this fighting going on within, and that even creates even more leaks. So that's part of the issue here.
Yeah, I just the point that you just made is apropos, I think, because Amy, the story we found out about the story about the phone check being done from a leak, and then we found out that there was from a leak that they were worried about leaks about the phone mm-hmm. checking story. Now, can you blame the White House for wanting to know who leaked? When you're in a meeting, you know how many people are in that meeting. You knew the leak came from somebody in that meeting. Right. What would you try to do? It's kind of ingenious to say, okay, here's an impromptu meeting. Drop your cell phones. We're going to look to see if you called any journalists. We're going to see if you used any messaging apps that use encryption that might make us suspicious that you were leaking. But the leakers will always find a way.
I was going to say, if you're the leaker, don't you have, I don't know, a burner phone that you leave at home and don't take to work with you? There was an interesting comment that I saw from Dana Perino, who's a former White House press secretary herself, and she kind of made this statement that felt a little bit Shakespearean, that in her experience, she always found that the person who complained the loudest about the leak was usually the leaker.
Well, and she's not the first press secretary to say that. Yeah. I mean, it goes all the way back to Clinton. They also, it's like, look, you can't really stop this. The only thing you can do is sort of try to manage it once the leak gets out there and create a narrative that works in your favor, if that's even possible. But the problem with coming out and forcefully saying we're going to stop leaks is getting people going like, no, you're not. And I'm going to leak that you can't, you know. So.
And there's more than a little irony in that. There was an interesting story this weekend in the New York Times where it compared President Trump's behavior when he was in New York and how he managed the New York media by constantly leaking, sometimes using a pseudonym and doing that. And now here we have a situation where trying to manage the White House press corps is a little harder job than managing the New York entertainment.
And that's the fascinating thing I found in that story, was talking about the difficulty that Trump and his people are having in trying to do that. The fact that D.C. is different from New York because you have all these agencies and you have all these connections, and the media in D.C. is so fragmented that you can't just go to one source and then hope that everybody else picks up on it. It just doesn't work that way.
And the media in D.C. have been there a lot longer than the president, the people in the administration.
And they're going to be there longer after he's gone. Yep.
Well, soon after all of this, President Trump tweeted that he will not be attending the White House Correspondents' Dinner, wished everyone well that night, telling him to have a great evening. The event isn't even until April 29th. Why announce this far out that you're not going to go?
Did we expect him to go?
I don't know if we did or not. I know we started talking about how different organizations were starting to cancel pre and post parties. We've talked a lot in the past about some of the ethical problems surrounding this.
I think he thought he did himself and the White House correspondents a favor by making that decision early on.
Okay.
Now they can plan for what should be, we hope, less of what they call nerd prom than it's been for years,
right?
With all the entertainers and such, and focus more on honoring journalists and awarding student scholarships. It won't be as high profile an event, obviously, but maybe it'll meet the original mission of that.
And I think many of those journalists who were participants and who came to the event back when it did focus on those things may decide to come back now that they don't have to go through this sort of this sort of impromptu red carpet kind of environment that had become the White House correspondents.
I did think it was pretty hilarious that on social media there were several people suggesting Alec Baldwin should sit in for the president. That's not going to happen, but it would be pretty funny if it did.
So when you talk about the idea of nerd prom, and one of the reasons that this event has gained such level of notoriety is because it shows up on C-SPAN. It's a way to fill time on CNN on a Saturday night. You think there's still going to be the general interest among the public in this?
I don't think it will be. I mean, I think what's going to go back to is just C-SPAN covering it because back in the day, it was just C-SPAN, and then you had CNN that picked up on it, and then you'd have a couple of others because of the celebrity of it and the celebrities showing up. If they aren't there, then there's really no reason because it takes that star factor out of it and the whole idea of journalists mingling with political operatives and Hollywood stars and this sort of thing. All that goes away and it gets back to what the dinner was supposed to be about.
Selfishly, I mean, we have graduate students who benefit from those scholarships.
Right.
Do we think that money is still going to be coming in at the same levels or higher potentially without the red carpet aspect? Are people still going to be as interested in going if the Kardashians may not be there?
I hope that these news organizations that spent so much money on tables and busing in, flying in celebrities or whatever will spend some of that money on scholarships. I worry that as it becomes less of a public event, less of a promotional event, less of a ratings driver, that maybe some news organizations will pull back. I hope not, but I worry about that.
I hope not. I hope that they will give because it's... If they really care about journalism and they care about where journalism is going, this is the generation that is going to be engaged in that, and they need to be supported.
Okay. With journalism and journalists under attack, we've got to find new ways to reach our audiences and to have them trust us again. For the New York Times, that's coming in part in the form of television advertising. In case you didn't see it Sunday night during the Oscars, here's a spot that ran during that telecast.
The truth is, our nation is more divided than ever.
The truth is, alternative facts are just plain delusional.
The truth is, the media needs to be held accountable.
The truth is, locker room talk is harmless.
The truth is, we need to put the safety of the American people...
The truth is, we need a full investigation of any type of
Russian... The truth is...
Sometimes playing video on the radio can be a little tricky. So let me tell you, over those bings you just heard appear the words, the truth is hard to find, the truth is hard to know, the truth is more important than ever. This was the first time in more than a decade that the Times has bought national TV time. Was it effective?
I think it was effective. I mean, I saw the ad, I saw the commercial. They ran a full page ad in Sunday's paper. I think
it's on bus shelters in the city.
Exactly, it's on the bus shelters in the city. I think they are drawing a line in the sand to basically say, look, our credibility has been challenged. And not just the New York Times, but the credibility of journalism as a whole has been challenged. And now is the opportunity for us to step out there and say, this is what we're going to do. And this is this is more important than the president. This is more important than the rhetoric. This is about what we bring to the democracy as a profession and as an institution. And I think this was effective in doing that.
Nice segue there. You brought up the word democracy. The Washington Post also has a new tagline that's appearing on its masthead: democracy dies in the dark.
It's kind of a dark message.
Isn't it?
I like it. And I think the history of it is very interesting because a lot of people would just think it was a reaction to President Trump. Apparently not. There's an interesting piece we have a link to, which describes how Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, heard Bob Woodward talking about this a while back. And he, Bob Woodward, got this quote, not from Watergate. He didn't make it up himself. He got it from a federal appeals court judge, you know, back pre-Watergate, talking about, you know, First Amendment rights. And so that's how it kind of bubbled up to finally it's appearing on the masthead and right on the front screen of the Washington Post. There are a lot of people who think it's, you know, it speaks truth. And there are a lot of people who are making fun of it. I mean, for example, apparently they kicked around a bunch of different ideas before they settled on democracy dies in darkness. They came up with one that was dauntless defenders of the truth, which sounds a little maybe too self-promotional.
I almost feel like you'd have to put on a cape.
Stephen Colbert was joking about it. He said maybe they rejected some other ones instead, like, no, you shut up.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, and I know that people are going to criticize this, but, you know, I do think that the press has gotten beaten up a lot, not just going back to the campaign, but definitely in the first month and a half of the Trump presidency. And this was an opportunity, or at least the New York Times and the Washington Post has looked at it. Here's an opportunity for us to sort of define who we are and to recreate this narrative about who the press is, what we do, and what we stand for, and our role and our place in American society.
Mike, I want to give you a second to plug a project that the Reynolds Journalism Institute has been working on, frankly, for more than a year at this point.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, having a new tagline or a slogan can be useful, but there are also some practical things that news organizations need to do if they're going to engender trust again with users. And we've been working on a project with Joy Mayer for the past year or so, where she's been talking to 14 different news organizations. Some of our students have been a part of this project. And basically, they've been trying to test different approaches to communicating with their public to develop trust for local news organizations. I won't, you know, summarize all of it, obviously, but if you go to trustingnews.org, you can get a lot more information about that.
Okay. If you have ever enjoyed a state rivalry, whether it be among friends or family, you may be happy to read U.S. News and World Report's newest project, or maybe not. It ranks all 50 states based on thousands of data points, measuring categories like healthcare, government, and infrastructure, and comparing the state's data in an overall rank. There's some heavy-duty calculating going on here. There's some subcategories where Missouri did pretty well.
Yeah, and of course, that's where we all went to first, right? Let's see where Missouri ranks. Right. And Missouri ranked 37th overall out of 50 states. Not so great. We ranked number one in one category, which is kind of interesting, and it relates to our show somewhat. And that was on the Missouri state government providing digital access to information. Number one in the country, tied with a couple of other states. We didn't do so well on some other stuff, though. I mean, for example, on health, you know, they found that Missourians don't go to the dentist often enough. We're fat. We smoke too much. And there's lots of ways in which Missouri didn't show up well. But on that one measurement, we did pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to me that, you know, Missouri ranks high in terms of providing that information. But then when you look at those other things, I mean, health, I mean, that relates right back to the fact that we have a high number of people on Medicare and Medicaid. The fact that our cigarette tax
is the lowest in the nation. Right? So it might
attribute to a lot of the things that you were just talking about. But, you know, it's good not to be at the bottom. I mean, we are higher than Kansas in ranking in that list and some other places. I mean, I am a little concerned about where we rank in education, but I'm not surprised, seeing as though, you know, we tend to have a problem when it comes to providing resources for education, both K-12 as well as higher ed.
So far, Governor Greitens hasn't responded to requests to talk about this, but I bet when he does, he's going to pull out one other number that we did well on compared to other states, and that was on our credit rating. Our government credit rating is very high, so good for us. I have to say, though, to Amy, the thing to me is, here's U.S. News and World Report coming out with this. The timing is very good. The time and U.S. News and World Report has had these college and university rankings for a long time, and though some of us in the higher education world think that those measures are not exactly foolproof and that too many universities are trying to gig their numbers artificially, I think this could have a pretty big impact.
Well, okay, and before we move on, I do want to say, in the interest of disclosure, the associate managing editor for U.S. News and World Report, who's heading up this project, is a former colleague and friend of mine, Mark Silva, who is behind this. Sunday night, it was definitely an Academy Awards ceremony to remember.
Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
Okay, so we all know I didn't stay up late enough to see that. But when I first heard it, when I woke up Monday morning, my first thought was, for real, Steve Harvey's not the only one to make this mistake.
yeah. I mean, this is not good for PricewaterhouseCoopers. I mean, it's, because people stayed up just to find out who won that. And then everybody's thinking, La La Land, okay, the predictors are right.
They're already making the speech.
And boom, the guy runs out and says, no, wait a minute, it's all wrong. And it's like, is this a spoof? Is this like Saturday Night Live going live?
Is this Gary from Chicago, like the next part?
And what's really funny to me, I mean, I feel sorry for them, obviously, but the guy who was handing out the wrong card had moments before been tweeting a picture he'd taken of Emma Stone when she'd just gotten the Best Actress nomination. Maybe he should have been paying attention to what was written on the envelope.
That's the part I didn't understand, is that, you know, if you... The only envelope that should have been there was that one envelope. Why are the others even out there?
Because they had one on each side, and so he got the wrong one.
Okay.
Although, let's just say that although it was a big mix-up, Moonlight winning the Best Picture was really something.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So let's touch on that for a second. Oscars not so white?
Not this year. But they still have a ways to go. I would not, they're not off the hook. They're not off the hook yet because, I mean, it's a systemic problem, and they need to basically show over the course of time that this is an inclusive environment and not just 1 year. 1 year does not make them off the screen yet. I mean, they've got to get it done.
Sure, a couple other good things too. The first Muslim American actor to win, you know, for Moonlight, that was great. And O.J. made America.
Which is
a fantastic, fantastic documentary that really has very little to do with O.J. Simpson.
Well, I mean, and ESPN is playing it up. I mean, they reran it right before Oscars. They're rerunning it again now. You're going to see that on ESPN for probably the next 6 months.
And it is a good 7 hours or so to watch the whole thing. I would recommend it to anyone who has the time. Speaking of time, we are out of time for this week's program. I invite you to read more about the topics that we talked about on today's program on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Acres for handling the audio. Our original theme music was composed by Tim Pilcher. Travis Meyer is our associate producer, and I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.